You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
When a revolution is successful, it's common practice to have a date that celebrates it. July 14th for France, October 1st for China. But everyone knows much happened before those dates, and much certainly happens after them. The uprising of the Egyptian people that reached its highest point so far in the sustained occupation of Tahrir Square in Cairo also was preceded by important actions. For example, those of the Kafaya movement, Kafaya meaning enough, we've had enough, in 2004-2005. But this morning we want to look forward rather than back to address the question, what has happened in Egypt since the uprising forced the resignation of President Hosni Mubarak? Our guest on the phone from London is Gilbert Ashkar. He is a Lebanese academic and author, currently professor at the School of Oriental and African Studies of London University. His most recent book is The Arabs and the Holocaust, The Arab-Israeli War of Narratives. Welcome, Gilbert, to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Thank you. Good morning.
Let's start with the occupation of Tahrir Square. Remind us of the main demands of the Egyptian uprising.
The most radically democratic wing of the movement wants a very thorough change in the political system, and especially radical change of the constitution instead of just amendments to the constitution as the military have been doing until now. So the demand for a constituent assembly, which was raised both in the Tunisian and Egyptian movement, and which has been achieved, as I mean, the principle of it in Tunisia, is still on the agenda of the movement in Egypt. And then you have everything related to the, let's say the what term to use, but the getting rid, let's say, of the remnants of the old regime. The movement now in Tahrir Square and all these demonstrations are focused on the necessity suing all these persons from Mubarak to his cronies and all that they should be put to trial, they should be sanctioned, they should be punished for what they did and all that. So this is a further dimension, but then you have the workers who are involved in these movements and who are demonstration on Friday in Tahrir Square. There was a very important participation of workers, and they were demanding the freedom to form unions. They were demanding the recognition of the ability for the unions that they have been forming, they have been creating during this movement since February, to get legal status. So you have a mixture of demands, working class demands, democratic demands, demands targeting Mubarak and his cronies. So a lot is still there to be done, and of course you have a struggle going on between, on the one hand, the military council, which wants to limit to abort this whole revolutionary process and limit it at superficial changes in the regime after the departure of a few people, including Mubarak, the amendments to the constitution, but without removing the constitution itself, which is utterly undemocratic constitution, and going quickly to organize parliamentary elections in order to say that, okay, it's done, it's finished, you got what you wanted, and that's it. But on the other hand, you have the radical wing of this movement, radical, again, in the democratic sense. I'm not speaking necessarily of left-wing radicals. Radicals in the sense of people wanting, you know, to change things from the roots in the political system, to turn it really into a democratic system, who are fighting for further changes in the country.
In this struggle between trying by the army to shut down further concessions to the democratic demands of the people, the army was nonetheless successful in getting a large amount of support on the referendum for their modest revisions of the Constitution, sidestepping totally the demand for a constituent assembly and taking time for democratic input. How do you explain the fact that nonetheless the referendum that the military put forward was successful from their point of view?
Well, there was no surprise in that. For several reasons. One, of course, major reason is that the movement that toppled Mubarak split on that issue, and the major force in the movement, in terms of organized force, the major organized force in the movement, which is the Muslim Brotherhood, very clearly is collaborating with the military and supporting them, and you know, going along with them in their attempt to stop the changes, the movement at the level achieved, and the Muslim Brotherhood therefore joined the military and joined the party, what used to be the ruling party, the NDP, National Democratic Party, which was Mubarak's party, and which is still there. It hasn't been dissolved in Egypt, contrary to the ruling party in Tunisia, which has been dissolved. So here again is a major difference between the two countries. So the Muslim Brotherhood, we saw the Muslim Brotherhood and other fundamentalist Islamic fundamentalist groups joining the military and the ex-ruling party in this campaign for a yes vote to these changes, the amendments in the constitution. And of course that means that you have two hugely powerful forces. One of them is the regime, or the whole forces of the regime. The second is the main force, the main organized force in the opposition, converging on this attitude. And then they use all kind of demagogic arguments. One of them, I mean, on the side of the Muslim Brotherhood, you had arguments going from demagogic arguments invoking the democratic reasons, like saying, well, this is to hasten the transfer of power to civilians, which, of course, the other part of the opposition counters by saying that from the start they were asking that instead of the military council, power be handed to civilian committee, presidential committee, with the task of overseeing the transition to the organization of democratic elections and the election of a constituent assembly. So you had this kind of argument. And another more demagogic one was the exploitation of religious of religion, and therefore a campaign explaining that the vote for against these amendments would be something aiming at actually removing the second article in the Constitution, which states that the Sharia, the Islamic Sharia, is the source of legislation in the country. And therefore that would be, a vote against religion and such arguments. And so they mobilized on all that, and they had, of course, much more means. They covered the walls of Egypt with posters and all that. They had banners everywhere. So much more means that than the Democrats, the liberal and left-wing forces. And then if you look at the result, knowing that it's always easier for people to vote yes than to vote no, the no vote is a much more political vote than the yes vote. That is, you can vote yes even with very low political conscience, which is not the case with a no vote. And so if you take all that into consideration, the fact that the no vote achieved close to one quarter is amazing already. It's quite an achievement. And when we look at the urban areas, we can see that the proportion of the no is much higher in those urban areas than in the rural areas, where political levels of political consciousness are quite lower. On the other hand, the overall participation was quite was actually low. The proportion of the electorate which went to vote on that was low, although it was higher than in the fake elections that were taking place earlier as a form of mobilization, but still that wasn't a major turnout.
I want to ask you about the army itself. Of course, the main generals have been a structural part of the Mubarak regime throughout its years. During the demonstrations originally in Tahrir Square, there was concern talked about that the rank-and-file soldiers did not want to shoot on the demonstrators, etc. Now in the demonstrations on Friday, there were some officers who apparently participated in the demonstration. I don't know what rank level they represented. The demonstration was attacked quite violently by the military, presumably on the orders of the high-ranking officer corps. Is the presence of some of those soldiers, nonetheless officers, in the demonstration an indication of some risks that the army is running with regards to maintaining a speeded up effort to curtail a democratic process?
It's very difficult for me to tell, because that would mean knowing what is taking place within the Egyptian army. The only thing I can say is that, of course, one of the key reasons why the army did not repress the movement from the start, was not involved in repressing the movement, and only security forces, police, and the rest tried to repress the movement at the beginning, but failed. And the movement in January very quickly acquired such a huge proportion that it became clear that any attempt at using the army against the demonstrators faced the risk of the soldiers refusing to shoot on the population and maybe joining them. And I think that's a key reason why the army was not used in the repression, and why Washington actually advised very, very strongly the Egyptian army not to intervene militarily. That's how we saw Washington turning into apostles of nonviolence, you know, making speeches after speeches from Washington, whether Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or all of them, you know, advising against any against the use of violence. Because they understood that that the risk was high, that then the situation would get beyond control, and so the army leadership played it, you know, as a kind of neutral force, and cultivated this image. Although I mean, anyone knowing the reality of power in Egypt would have known that these guys are the backbone of power, are the backbone of the regime, and Mubarak is the tip of the iceberg, but they are the iceberg. And nevertheless, there were a lot of illusions in the movement in the first weeks. A lot of slogans about the army and all that, which, well, if they were aimed at the rank and file of the army, the soldiers, well, would have been fine. But actually, in the minds of many, there was no distinction. And so when Mubarak handed power to the army, a part of, you know, the movements and all that, because of the low level of conscience, critical conscience on this issue, had a lot of illusions. Now we can say that these illusions, to a great extent, have disappeared. And now, even instead of, you know, slogans praising the army, what you see in Tahrir are slogans, for instance, saying the people want to overthrow the marshal, the mushir, that is Tantawi, who is the sorry, the commander in chief, I mean the chief of the army, of the armed forces. And you can see even in the reports from journalists and all that covering these events, how there are a lot of statements among the demonstrators, this time against the army, very critical of the army. The army, I mean, when I say the army here, I mean the general staff, I mean the council of the armed forces, the supreme council of the armed forces, that is the army leadership. So you, now there is an increasing awareness that these guys are very corrupt themselves. They are as much a part of the general corrupt system as Mubarak and his family were, and other people. So this consciousness is there, and it is increased by the acts, the action, the decisions of the armed forces, whether their attempt to prohibit demonstrations and strikes, especially also strikes and all that, to criminalize them, make them punishable by law, by repression, and or the actual repression of that we have seen now repeatedly, the last one in the night from Friday to Saturday. Mm-hmm. Was particularly vicious, but it was not the first one. There have been other instances of very vicious repression, including very vicious sexist treatment of women demonstrators and the rest.
We'll have to leave it at there, Gilbert. That's the time we have. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Bye-bye. Our guest has been Gilbert Ashkar. He's a Lebanese academic, author, anti-war activist, and socialist. Currently, he's a professor at the School of Oriental and African Studies of London University. Gilbert Ashkar's most recent book is The Arabs and the Holocaust, The Arab-Israeli War of Narratives.